To be welcoming back to the show with me, Peter Canova, who has authored the first of a book of a trilogy that he's going to be producing for all of us in his first book called Pope Annalisa. I had the pleasure of having Peter with me. What an incredible man and very gifted and very knowledgeable. We were together a few months ago, and it was so impressive and so important, the discussion that we were having, that, of course, we ran out of time. An hour goes by quite fast on the air. So I asked him to join me again. And, that's the phone number right there. Yeah, Peter. And sorry, we're working together to get him on the line. And so anyway, I asked Peter to join me again. So those of you that are listening, I'd like you to go to his website if you're at a computer, and you can do so. It's quite simply popeannalisa.com. It's quite a splendid website, and you can be poking around on the website while we talk today. And if you have any questions, please feel free to give us a call during this next hour. It's P-O-P-E, Pope, and all one word, Anna, A-N-N-A, Lisa, L-I-S-A .com. So that's great. We'll be hooking up with that website and going and bringing Peter on in just a second. My second hour today, we're going to be leaving the global topic of spirituality, religion, and the Catholic Church, and moving into the real world here on Earth that pertains to breast cancer. My guest, Anne-Marie Bennett, whose book, Bright Side of the Road, takes a real intimate look at what a woman goes through when she's diagnosed with breast cancer. And then in the very third hour, we're going to honor the men by bringing on a replay interview that I did about prostate cancer. So I'm hoping that those of you listening can tune in and join us for all of these. But anyway, why don't we go ahead and welcome on the air with us today, Peter Canova. Hello, Peter.
Hi, Catherine. How are you today?
I'm quite well, thank you. I know that we just brought you on now, and I didn't have a chance to say hi before we go live. So hello to you on the air.
Thank you.
Listen, Peter, I'm so happy to have you back with me, because I was thinking about it this morning, those people who follow along with my show, and certainly I got a lot of wonderful feedback about how fascinating your book sounded, and I'm sure our interview drove a lot of people to go get the book through Amazon or whatever means. But I'm so excited to be able to have a chance to talk to you again, because I was thinking this morning, I know that probably in the last 2 months of you being interviewed so much and just the ball rolling and the book being out more, that things have changed for you, and I'm really curious about the energy that shifted, if anything has at all, and you know, if your views have changed, if you've become more concentrated in any particular area of interest around what the book is talking about, or if you find that the world is wanting to see one certain aspect of the book. And before we answer that question, maybe you can introduce those people who might be listening to us for the first time to the book by giving us your description of maybe a brief synopsis.
Sure, I'll be happy to do that. First, let me ask you, I'm getting just a little bit of background noise here. I can hear you fine, but are you hearing me okay there?
You're really good here.
Okay, that's fine. I just have a little bit of noise here, but not enough to prevent us from going forward.
Okay.
Anyway, Pope Annalisa is book one of a trilogy called The First Souls Trilogy. And that is the saga of the first fall of spirit into material existence. And Pope Annalisa, the first book, deals with the rise of a miraculous African nun to the papacy in a background of murder, betrayal, and assassination in the near future world of 2025, where the great nations are struggling over dwindling resources. And the confrontation between the Western world and Islam has reached a dangerous peak. Now, after becoming pope, demonic symbols begin appearing around the Vatican, the Catholic Church breaks apart, and the Western world is divided on the eve of an American nuclear confrontation with Iran. And throughout much of the book, it's not really clear whether the main character, Pope Annalisa, the female pope, is the savior or the destroyer of this harsh new world. Did she cause the problems, or is she a potential solution to the problem?
Right.
And Pope Annalisa deals with war, religious conflict, and divisive social issues that are very current in today's news, even.
Right.
And but it points to a path for reconciliation, really, by developing a higher awareness of the real root problem of our human condition. And so the themes underlying the book really deal with the recovery of a genuine, lost, universal spiritual tradition that I have really run across in my readings and my meditations over time. And the book speaks a lot to that subject.
Right. So backing up, I think knowing more about you and how, because let me tell you something, I've read a lot, and I'm going to underline a lot, and we didn't say, but we should, that this book is in novel form, but very clearly has so many underpinnings and threads that are so real and themes that are so pertinent to, as you said, what's going on in the real world. That, you know, you kind of have to shake your head and say, wait a minute, am I reading fiction or nonfiction here?
Yep.
You know, and I don't think that was, a mistake, that the book was intended to have actually be more powerful by having it being written in that format with that. But you obviously have, you know, quite a unique story yourself. I mean, you could probably write a book just about you and it would be just also a bestseller. Because you must have some remarkable experiences and natural inclinations and divine, I think, abilities yourself to be able to take you into the ability to write something such as this. It's so powerful, a book. Can you give us some background about you?
Well, thank you. That's a lot of high praise, and I'm not sure it's all deserved. But my background was really, I guess the one thing that might have distinguished me from average person was maybe I was a little bit more of a seeker, and I came to a dissatisfaction or a real questioning of life at a very early age, not feeling very kind of comfortable about the world, and that really didn't have to do with the average things. I mean, I was a popular kid in school. My family was pretty well off. I got a good education. It was really nothing to do with material circumstances. It was just really kind of a soul ache, I guess, is the only way that I can describe it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just tried to pursue some answers from the time I was really in my teens. And at some point in time, I ran across a group that really sort of made a curriculum out of helping you cultivate your higher awareness. And it was during the course of going through that I discovered a real facility for doing intuitive medical readings. And when I started doing my first accurate medical readings, just basically by somebody giving me the name, age, and address of somebody with no more information, it really kind of opened up a whole new world. All of a sudden, I felt connected to a source of information, and that source of information started to come through more steadily, and it permeated other aspects of my life. All kinds of things and phenomena started happening to me. I developed the ability to do remote viewing very accurately, and, psychokinesis, which is really in a way kind of a little bit of a psychic parlor trick. I mean, it doesn't really have much use, but except for the fact that it's a little bit of a demonstration of some of the energies and other types of things. Synchronicities would happen in my life. They would give me messages, important messages, even ones that saved my life on one or two occasions.
Right.
And it at that point, I really felt I made a quantum leap in graduating from faith in things unseen, which is really, taking something on a proposition that you can't prove, to having direct experience mm-hmm. of that unseen energy. And that really changed my life because I graduated from faith to knowledge. And that's a lot of the theme in the book and a lot of where I hope I can help guide other people to reach that stage.
Right. Tell me the time frame that was going on, Peter. What are we looking at? How long ago?
Yeah, well, of course we're dating me, but that's okay. That was back in the 1970s.
Okay, and that's all right. Being dated, I mean, more power to you as you get older.
Oh, I am dated. I just don't have the stamp on me. I'm just going to keep going.
I know, good. But the important thing here is that when I hear about, because I asked you during our last interview, with all due respect, who are you? And I meant that in a very kind way. But I was so curious because your book stimulated me as an innocent reader picking it up and reading it, like I'm sure many, many readers, at such profound, deep ways that I was like, wow, who is this person writing this book? I mean, this is some really remarkable writing, and also the ability to, I'm always in awe of people that can weave together, such complicated and yet beautiful storylines that come out in such a powerful way as yours did. And yet it was so filled with, I think, divine inspiration or inspiration and a knowing that comes from somewhere. And so I was curious, more curious than ever, about just these threads back to you. And I know that we talk about, a lot of people talk about soul purpose, right? And someone at some period in their life finally saying, oh, that's what I'm here for. That's what all these experiences I've had are pushing me to do or leading me toward, you know? And I just wondered if your path and the things as you awaken in your life and you go, as you say, from faith to knowledge, if you become clearer and clearer about just what you're here to be doing.
Well, you know, it started off, I guess you could say the bottom line is I always had a desire to help people. That desire didn't take the normal forms. I wasn't like a joiner or a person who'd go out and volunteer at a hospital or things of that nature, but I did have a desire to help people. I was just trying to find my best way to express it. And I guess early on, it would have been through the intuitive medical readings that I did. I used to do those for free in an old working-class neighborhood in Boston that I used to live in when I was a student. I'd have people lined up outside my door. I wouldn't charge them, and I'd always tell them to go see their doctor, but, you know, I'd give them the reading. At some point, I really decided that rather than trying to help on a one-on-one basis like that I had a desire to write, and I was able to combine those different streams in my life of the writing ability with the spiritual background and the desire to be helpful to try and produce a work which is embodied in the First Souls and Pope Annalisa that would be kind of, I guess, streetlights along the path of our spiritual road or spiritual experience.
Right.
Not trying to preach a particular point of view to people, but to try and open up awareness of certain spiritual energies and spiritual possibilities that would help launch people on their own road and give them at least some faith from the experience of another person that there really is a source of guiding intelligence and information out there that can be very, very beneficial in our lives.
I think there's certainly a plethora of authors and seekers and wisdom keepers appearing on the horizon and certainly in our forefront, you know, these days, these past years that are writing more and more and lecturing and doing whatever they can to some of the people that are delivering these messages to us in the hopes of people seeing the light and seeing the truth and coming into an awakening like you're doing. I'm always curious when someone chooses to do so in such an explosive way. To me, the book is very positively explosive. What really made you think, okay, I think it would be better received if I do it in a novel form, in a trilogy form, as opposed to just diving in and producing a non-fictional piece that just is filled with lots of facts and, you know, pieces of information that you've gathered over the years?
Well, you're kind of reading my mind and my train of thought here now. I after your last question, I was thinking about that. I think that maybe at an unconscious level, it was just my love of writing that caused me to want to do this in a fictional form. On a more conscious level, I probably saw a lot of people out there in the marketplace writing self-help books and spiritual self-help books. The bookshelves in the metaphysical bookstores are full of them, and quite a few of them are very good.
Right.
And but you know, the one thing that I realized was that I was very aware of male and female energies, right brain and left brain type energies, and I believe for quite some time now that the real way that people learn, the only real way that people learn, and the only way to really open the door to a spiritual existence is by using both those faculties, by using our emotion, our heart, and by using our logic and our mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only the two in combination that really impress us with true learning and absorption of material, and especially material sometimes that's hard to comprehend, so that in the form of a fictional novel, I was able to pull in the emotions, and I was able to create characters that lived and breathed and were emotional characters that people could identify with, so that the intellectual content of the book would be delivered through those characters, and people could identify with that content both in an intellectual and an emotional sense. And I feel in that way, people absorb much more and learn much more, and I think it's a more pleasant experience than reading, something that may be valuable, but more along the line of a dry nonfiction or scholarly work.
Absolutely. The word dry came up while you were talking, too, for me, but what was really interesting in what you just said and expressed was And the feeling I got was that, you know, as we are, if you could imagine if someone had some sort of scanner or imaging device which allowed us to see the parts of us on all of our layers of bodies, if you would, you know, from the outer energy rings in, and what was being stimulated by a particular experience. And that means the holistic experience with incorporating, as you say, the male, the classic iconic sort of archetypes of male and female that our society has and dogma has delivered to us. If you could see that being those things being triggered in us, what you're saying is it's so nice because through the ability of the fictionalized delivery, you get to subtly sort of stimulate more of those triggers, if you would, in people or those points of energy in a human being than if it were just something which was, okay, this is fact, read it, and you're going to like it or not, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, emotion is not always conceptual. It doesn't always put things together to sort of give you a picture of where you want to go. By the same token, an intellectual proposition often is devoid of the desire to really bring that experience to life. So what we're talking about is really, you know, sort of combining both the rocket fuel and the guidance system here to produce an experience.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Have you found, you know, a little bit more about how this is being received? Tell me, because it's been out how many months now, the book?
Oh, it's been out probably about three or 4 months. And, okay. You know, obviously, with any new book, I'm working hard to try and build up sales. And sales are going moderately okay, but because I really still looking to sort of get that big break and get the book into the mainstream. And I've got a publicity agent, new publicity agent in Los Angeles right now, who in the first month I've worked with him is really, I think, doing well for me. Mm-hmm. And I've been on many radio shows like yours. I love doing these radio shows and being able to communicate with the audiences or the listeners.
Mm-hmm.
And the book has won right out of the bat the first two awards that the book entered. You're probably aware it won the a couple of Nautilus Awards and the Independent Publishers Award. And I'm waiting on two more that'll be announced in the fall to see how the book fares there. So critically speaking, it's just been fabulous. I mean, I've been getting reviews and people from all walks of life, both, you know, just average readers and professionals, people in the movie and industry, the radio and television and so forth, mm-hmm. in the media reading the book. And universally, it's just people have just embraced the book, and it's really been heartwarming to see that. As far as, you know, getting it out there into the sort of more, let's say, bestseller category, well, obviously that's something I'm aiming for because I really would like as many people as possible to benefit from, you know, reading the book at one level or another, and I'm still working in that direction.
Right. Just as a curiosity, because I don't know this, as an author, how does it happen that a book is translated in other languages?
Yeah, well, actually, that's funny you should mention that, because in October, I'm heading over to Frankfurt, Germany, to the Frankfurt Book Fair. I've just signed a deal with a substantial international rights group that essentially they're agents, and they go to different meetings, and the Frankfurt Book Fair is probably the biggest exchange of these meetings, where they will meet with foreign publishers. And they'll basically make the case for the book there to the foreign publishers. And then if the foreign publisher picks it up, it is part of the responsibility of the foreign publisher then to go ahead and translate that book into whatever language of the market is that they want to sell the book.
I would imagine that would be a tricky one for the translation part, you know, that, you know, as a creator of something, wouldn't you want to have, wouldn't you want to make sure that it was being translated accurately?
Well, you certainly would. It would mm-hmm. be the same thing as if it was made into a movie or a screenplay.
Right.
You'd want to try and, you know, have some faithfulness to the original work in there. And that certainly is a consideration. So I guess what I would say is that will be a happy problem, and I'll cross that bridge when I come to it as it is accepted by the first foreign publishers.
I'm sure it's going to be a happy problem for you.
Yeah.
I certainly see that. But and then before we leave the media and the marketing of this, because it's so fascinating, I can't wait until it's a movie, and it's got to be a movie. I mean, I say that occasionally when I've read a book and I have the pleasure of being with the author, but this one for sure has got to be, you know, just people right away saying, okay, this is going to be, and we can hardly wait for the, because they love especially trilogies and, you know, and more. So any idea about that?
Well, yeah, the book is in the hands of some real blockbuster movie folks in Hollywood right now. I cannot tell you how it's going, whether it's going to go anywhere. I just had one very recently through my PR agent express a real interest in the book, and I'm going to sort of see how that goes. In a way, it's nice to think that you have people of that caliber out there reading your book, but I'm also very realistic about it because I did come from a business background. So besides being metaphysical, I'm also a Capricorn. I have a practical side to me.
Yeah.
And my actual goal was really always to get the book onto the bestseller list and really get it popular as a book, because then at that point, when you go to talk to people in the movie industry, you have some leverage in order to essentially insert yourself into the process and make sure that the adaptations stay artistically faithful to what you're trying to convey.
Right.
and for other reasons, whereas if you take a relatively unknown book and it's picked up oftentimes by the Hollywood crowd, they kind of want to buy it for a song, in a sense, you know, put an option on it or something like that,
right.
A five or maybe even a six-figure option, and then you sort of disappear and you don't really know what's going to happen to your work at that point.
Right.
And I have too much invested in this work, and I have too much love into this work, and I really basically have high aspirations for how I would like to see this conveyed to an audience out there, that I would ever be tempted to get into a deal like that.
Right. And I would imagine, you know, how many people have always come back from watching a film and say, oh, I love the book so much better. And, you know, I mean, your book is a pretty large undertaking for anybody if they were to try to take it into a screenplay mode, you know.
Well, it is. It's an epic.
Yes.
So it's not like a little slice of life, you know, half-hour indie movie. It's really an epic that would be,
really,
yeah, a high budget. And, you know, again, one of the reasons I was really hoping that, you know, we could make the book popular as a book first is that if it goes into the movies and if it's not well done there, then it could really hurt the book itself.
Right.
Because if people see a bad movie, they say, well, you know, why would I want to read the book?
Right, so, absolutely.
All kinds of considerations that you have to go, temptations and considerations.
Right, absolutely, like life itself. Tell me, what my original question when I started the show today, what, having been interviewed so much, and I know I've followed along with your press releases when you're going to be on a show and whatnot, so I know you've been picked up by a number of people wanting to know more about the book and you.
Mm-hmm.
What, if anything, have you learned from all the times being interviewed about, you know, just the way people are handling the book, and is there any part that any surprises for you in now that the book's out and the way people are responding to it, or anything in particular that they're latching on to as far as one element of the book, or any changing for you in your thoughts since it's been out?
Well, yes, there is changing for me, but let me answer the first part of your question as far as how people are reacting to the book. I guess the only, I won't maybe surprise, but really more of a satisfaction is to see just how many people like the book for so many different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And there's really, the book is written on multiple levels, so there's really something in there from the person who's just looking for a great thriller, a commercial, you know, type of read for the summer, to the people who are really looking for something more profound on the spiritual side. And I've had people who are of fundamentalist persuasions read this and they love the book.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not offended by it, which, you know, might seem odd for those who have read the, or, you know, just looking at the whole premise of the book as we're talking about here in the show, you might think that fundamentalists or staunch Catholics or other people who are more of orthodox religious persuasions might be turned off by the book or offended by it, but on the contrary, they're most of the people I've read that would identify themselves that way have really enjoyed the book, and I think in part because while the book is trying to teach us to think outside of those boxes, it's also respectful of the boxes.
Mm-hmm.
There's many people out there who kind of engage in church bashing and you know, kind of poking fun at people for fundamentalist beliefs. And I don't feel that way. Pope Annalisa doesn't feel that way, and the book doesn't come off that way, because I think everybody has to be respected. No matter how much we disagree with somebody's point of view, everybody's spiritual point of view has to be respected, because that's the expression of their seeking at that time. Now, I guess the only place you could draw the line is sometimes if it goes overboard and expresses itself as violence in the form of, you know, if you don't believe in my version of God, then, you know, we're going to exterminate you.
Right.
That certainly has to be resisted. But other than maybe fundamental Islam right now, that's not what we're experiencing here in the United States.
Right.
And I really think that people's points of view have to be respected. And if you want to present another point of view to somebody, the best way to do it is not by clubbing them over the head and telling them that everything they believe is baloney, but it's by saying, look, here's another way to look at things while being respectful of where they are.
Right, absolutely. And then the second part, anything, you know, change for you just, you know, in your own ideas about, because, you know, this is the first of three books that you're writing. So have you learned something? I mean, you obviously have not begun the second of the books, correct?
I have. In fact, good. I was writing large chunks of it just before we got on air here.
Oh.
but, yeah, I'm learning a tremendous amount, and it's a really interesting process, Catherine, because, it's sort of like I feel a little bit detached from my book, my first book, like I didn't write it. So I go back, and I look at it, and I think about it, and I start to extract themes to talk to people about in, let's say, a live context, as if I, you know, as if I were at the Learning Annex, or I was, giving a talk in front of a group of people who had invited me. Because it's one thing to write a book; it's another thing to write about your book and tell people what the book is about, and speak of the things in a let's say a more compressed context, like a 1 hour talk to people. What's the meaning of this, you know, for you? Sure, there's a lot of interesting stuff in the book, but can we focus on specific topics? Can we concentrate on specific aspects of the book, particularly in a way that might be interesting to, you know, audience X or audience Y or audience Z? So I have been doing a lot of, writing little, I would call them essays or notes, in preparation for speaking in front of more groups of people, which I'm being invited to, and it has caused me to look at my own work in a different perspective and maybe elaborate on certain parts of the book in detail. For instance, one of the things that is alluded to in the book, but I didn't really dwell on it, is the whole fascinating history of early Christianity and the fact that there were really two Christianities. There was a public church and there was a hidden church. There was a church that spoke an outer message, which became the Orthodox churches, the that we all know today, the Catholic and Protestant churches. And yet there was the hidden church that taught the secret teachings of the Christ that unfortunately was exterminated over several centuries, and we lost much of the benefit of their beautiful thoughts, although we've recovered some of it, and it's reignited a kind of spark that I think is going to very much affect the future of Christianity
right.
in the Western world.
Is this
so?
I've been
writing on those topics.
About? Yeah, is this the Gnostics you're writing about?
It is. It's the Gnostics. It focuses on the Gnostics, but actually the Gnostics are sort of the mooring for an anchor line that's buried deep in the water that goes way back to the ancient pagan mystery school of the Mediterranean basin and Egypt. At one time, if you want to think of it in this way, there was actually sort of an Ivy League of mystical schools spread all over the ancient world, stretching from India to the Mediterranean. And in these mystery schools, they really had courses of study and initiation into universal wisdom traditions about where humanity came from, how the creation came about, and so forth. And that merged at one point, at least in the Mediterranean, with Greek philosophy. And it's really fascinating because the mystics, you could say, were the intuitives. They were the heart, and the heart that we were talking about, the right brain folks we were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The philosophers were a little bit more on the left brain side. They were the rationalists. But there was a blending of that Greek philosophy and mystical wisdom that produced probably the highest spiritual knowledge that we have ever had, at least in recorded history. And we've probably regressed from that point, if anything.
Yes.
And now we're starting to, and what I'm trying to do in my books is rediscover that whole system of wisdom teaching for the benefit of the modern world.
Absolutely, and that's the exciting thing, I think, and that's probably why even at some very as-yet-to-be-discovered you know, deeper level for me. And I think that's one of the great things that you're doing. It's like, you know, you're planting seeds and you're doing a great job at doing it in people who are reading the book, because so many of us who are would consider themselves in this modern day really seekers of truth have such a willingness to look back and say, wow, the truth's been here all along, but it's been disguised. It's been hidden behind that bush. It's been, you know, transformed into something else over there, you know. And when we get exposed to things like Pope Annalisa, the book, we're being fed the basic ingredients that will, in fact, I think, sprout out and have us naturally go guide ourselves toward finding this this collective, you know, return to, I think, what the truth is, right?
Yeah, and let me sort of wet the listeners' palates by giving you some concrete examples.
Yes.
Of early Christianity and later or Orthodox Christianity, the version that we've been handed down today, because there was a spiritual teaching. It was very clear in the Bible and in letters from the early church fathers that Jesus had two teachings, one for the masses and then one he would teach to the disciples and to people who were described as spiritually mature. And those teachings, the secret teachings, formed the understanding of the inner core of original Christians. So let's take some of the concepts that they had, just the basic theological concepts, and compare them to what they were and what they became. So in the original Christian understanding of the nature of God, God is consciousness. God flows its consciousness and essence into psychic experience through the soul and then into physical experience through the body. So there really was, in their view, never any true separation of God from humanity. There was only an apparent one. Now, the nature of God in Orthodox Christianity or literal Christianity became God as an all-powerful being, kind of like an emperor up there on a throne, who created humans out of nothing as separate beings from himself, and then he endowed them with souls. So he dispenses justice or grace according to human actions, whether they're good or bad, for his own purposes. It's this sort of paternalistic vision of this stern, you know, judgmental God as a being apart from us and judging us. And that's a huge difference from saying, well, wait a minute, you are God. You really are God's essence that's being expressed in different realms of existence.
Mm-hmm.
You can see the huge difference that that would make in your whole outlook of life from those two different views.
Mm-hmm.
Now, flowing from that concept, let's talk about the idea of sin. Now, sin, to the ancient not Christians or Gnostic Christians, simply meant error. And the error was diverting or focusing our consciousness, our individual consciousness, to the physical as being a separate reality without recognizing our true source as spiritual consciousness projected in physical experience. So there is no real original sin in the views of the Gnostics or original Christians, except the only original sin might be being born into the material world and forgetfulness. We are born into this world forgetting of what our source is. And there's a purpose behind that. The purpose of forgetfulness is to make us feel like we're individual beings so we can have the illusion of individual experience,
mm-hmm.
which is the only way, you know, if everything is one, that's pretty much the only way you could have the experience of being individual is by some illusory experience.
Mm-hmm.
But now sin in the Orthodox Church became a disobedience or giving offense to this judgmental, paternalistic God. And original sin was pretty rugged, because that means we're all tainted with it just for the virtue of being born because of the misdeeds of two souls, Adam and Eve.
Mm-hmm.
And what was their sin? Their sin was trying to gain higher knowledge or awareness from the tree of knowledge. And even worse, very suspiciously, the God of the Old Testament feared that they would partake of the tree of life, which would have made them aware of their immortal nature, and they would become like us, was the quote from the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you see these two contrasts in the whole ideas of sin. One of them is very degrading to the human being, the Orthodox vision, whereas the Gnostic version of sin simply means we make mistakes, but we have the ability to correct those mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And the repentance, another concept. Now, the original word in Greek for repentance is metanoia, and metanoia means a change of heart.
Mm.
And a change of heart is the instinctual feeling of emptiness with the way we exist in the material view of life. It's that feeling I told you that impelled me to start seeking that dissatisfaction I had, that deep soul dissatisfaction,
right,
I had thinking something
yeah.
was wrong.
Yeah.
That was repentance in the Gnostic view. It's a redirecting of our awareness to seek the higher truth behind appearances. Now, we cannot sin in the eyes of God in the Gnostic view because we are one with God.
Right.
But we can forget that fact, and so we require a change of heart to redirect ourselves towards remembrance of our oneness with, you know, with the divine mind.
Right.
Now, repentance in the Orthodox version, again, was a very simplistic, literal type of expression, which was it's the confession of and the contrition for our transgressions against the will of God. And it's usually done to avoid some form of punishment now or in the afterlife. That,
right.
That's been the traditional Christian view. And, you know, I don't want to take up a lot of time here, but we could go on with these different terms, the different meanings of salvation, the whole concept of the Christ, the different meanings that the Orthodox and the Gnostics had of the crucifixion and the resurrection. Essentially, the Gnostics turned everything that that we say today on its head and looked at it from an opposing point of view. So it makes it extremely interesting for people who want to, let's say, get another spiritual vision to look at the opposite end of the spectrum and kind of encompass the whole arena.
It's pretty easy to understand why the Orthodox would fight to keep buried the Gnostic view of things. Because if you give up your Orthodox viewpoint, then you give up your power over the people.
Well, sure, because the Orthodox viewpoint was very much tied into the structural aspects of the church and the church hierarchy. Mm-hmm. In a way, if you take the Gnostic point of view, you don't really need priests and you don't really need a church. Mm-hmm. Every person can be their own church by taking spiritual responsibility, and there's the key. You got to take responsibility.
Right.
to seek within, because the answers are within. By examining your own consciousness, you can ultimately lead to the one consciousness that supports that and start to get that information that we talked about earlier for guidance of our lives. So what would be the need then for, priests or clerics and a hierarchy? So that was a very dangerous notion to an Orthodox church, which, of course, by that time had become married to the Roman Empire and so become obsessed with their authoritarian point of views, and they couldn't really tolerate that kind of free thinking anymore and essentially physically exterminated the Gnostics and the early Christians and burnt their books.
Right. That's one of the main themes of the book, too, is this power of the church to hold on to these this control and these ideas, you know, based on that. I'd like to go back to something you said earlier, because it's just, for me, a curious thing you said, and it brought up a question for me, and I would just like to hear what you think about it. Now, we're talking about Christianity, Orthodox, and the teachings, the hidden teachings and whatnot that were extinguished by the Orthodox leg of the church, Christianity. But you said early on that Jesus had two ways he was teaching. He was teaching to the masses, and he was teaching a different sort of different lessons to the spiritually mature.
Yes.
My curiosity is, where did those that he taught, that he considered spiritually mature and spiritually mature, where did they get their teachings from before Jesus? So what made them spiritually mature before being given the lessons and embracing the lessons that Jesus was teaching?
Right. Well, of course, we can't know that exactly, but we can make some guesses about it. I would think that the spiritually mature in those days would have been a combination of different groups of people. I mean, clearly, just take the Gnostics themselves. Gnosticism didn't arise with Christianity. Gnosticism was around before Christianity. So this secret wisdom tradition that we're talking about, the things that Jesus taught, which were some of the things that we have just covered here about the nature of God and the meaning of repentance and all these other concepts.
Mm-hmm.
These were concepts that had been out there from time immemorial, from the mists of time, ancient Sumeria, ancient Egypt, India, and so forth. And although they had variations according to the different cultures and geographic areas, the essential threads of what they taught conceptually about God, human beings, and the creation of the universe were the same. And when Jesus came along, or the Christian story came along, the Gnostics readily embraced it, seeing it as a highest expression or a continuation of this teaching that had already been in existence, so that they subscribed to the theory that God would send light bringers periodically into the world in order to correct the spiritual course when things were going astray. In fact, there's a very explicit quote in the Indian epic, the Mahabharata, where Krishna, who is the deity, says that when evil is on the rise and good is on the wane, I incarnate from age to age to thrust virtue back on its throne. And you see, this is the same thing that the Gnostics would have seen in Jesus and the Christian story, which is a very high expression of this mystical tradition, which they were already familiar with. Mm-hmm. I also believe that besides philosophers, there were probably a lot of Greek philosophers or people influenced by Hellenistic philosophy, people who were clued into these mystery schools that would have been part of those spiritually mature. I also just think that certain people, maybe it's part of the soul progression of their life, are just born into a particular life ready. They're ready to receive, they're ready to seek, and they're ready to receive. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a mystery that may be part of individual soul growth. Mm-hmm. And they may not have had any formal teaching in any particular life, but it's intrinsic in the pattern of their former existence that they're prone to seek out these kinds of this kind of awareness.
I absolutely agree with you, and I think that it makes perfect sense to me, and it resonates with me just from my own belief system that I think just because it was thousands of years ago doesn't mean that people were stupid or just intuitively or divinely inspired or whatever you want to call it. I think people come into an incarnation programmed or ready to go to do whatever they're there to do, and they have a purpose in their life. And I think that we have had the ball moving down the hill and the spiritual consciousness growing, decade after decade or century after century because of these people that lead the way.
And I think it's kind of interesting. I'm working in my second book, I'm working on a little theory here, which I call the seminal idea theory of history. And as I look in different ages, and let's coordinate them with astrological ages, so you know, you have the age of Aries, which was about 2000 BC up to 1 AD, and then you have the Piscean age that started around the time of Christ, 1 AD, up to our present time, and we're on the cusp now between the Piscean and the Aquarian age. And it seemed like each age had its motivating ideas, and I think that picture shows us that we don't always progress in a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
We do progress in a spiral, I believe. I do believe that things can go upward, but I believe in the course of that spiral, they can go up and down depending upon our choices in any given age.
Mm-hmm.
So that in the age of Aries, the two great motivations I saw were mysticism and philosophy. That was when all the great mystic traditions, the Upanishads, the Veda, the Tao Te Ching, were all formulated during that age of Aries. And then you go into the age of Pisces, and you sort of see a decline there with the rise of the idea of empire and religion,
mm-hmm.
and the empire being the Roman Empire, which was like sort of, you know, your real, almost sort of fascistic, militaristic, highly organized, society that demanded obedience to usually one central figure or at least a small group of figures on one hand, and then you had religion, which was a degraded understanding of spirit in the other. And those were the motivating factors of that age. The motivating ideas I see of our current age are science and spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And by science, there's a dialectic that goes on within each age because neither of those ideas stays the same during the course of the age.
Mm-hmm.
What I see happening right now, and this is my, if I'm going to make one prediction on the show for that goes out for the next 100 years, this is the prediction, that the traditional version of materialistic science, that the predominant science that we have being taught in the schools today, which its essential philosophy is that life started from matter, that life was the result of collisions of various particles that eventually formed complex organisms that eventually led to things like human beings and brains and everything else, without ever giving a good explanation of how dead material can form live organic substances. But that has been the prevailing view. And the prevailing view and on the religious side, of course, has been these Orthodox religions we have. But I feel that in our lifetime, we're going to see those two superseded by a new vision and a new idea.
Mm-hmm.
Quantum physics is overthrowing all the notions of classical science,
mm-hmm.
because they're now saying that the only way that we can explain all the paradoxes and phenomena and anomalies that we detect in the quantum world is if we understand that consciousness came first. And matter came afterwards. So that it was consciousness essentially that formed everything that we understand in creation, including matter, and it's still in operation in terms of its effect and organization, and it's up to us to sort of detect its presence, and that's what quantum science is trying to do in its own objective way. Then on the other hand, we have the recovery of this ancient spiritual tradition, which is saying the exact same thing
right. As
quantum science is today. In fact, you can take almost every theory, every main theory of quantum physics, and you can find passages in the Gnostic Gospels that are describing the same thing in non-technological terms. It's almost eerie the way that they correlate. So I predict that they're at a higher level, that traditional science is going to be overthrown, traditional religion is going to recede into the background, and that quantum physics and this recovered spirituality are going to join hands at a higher level and point our way to a new stage of evolution.
I have to absolutely agree with you, and it's interesting because, and that's also one last thing, is it also the quantum physics also leads us to the spiral timeline instead of this linear one where...
Or circular.
Right, yeah. Circular, you know, where everything's sort of happening at once and all that. But no, I think that's absolutely accurate and true, and it's almost like we began really perfectly smart and knowing, and then we went stupid for a while, didn't we?
You know, like I say, that spiral we're talking about is not always an upward spiral. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a downward spiral. Sometimes it's an upward spiral. The good news is it's a spiral, not a circle, so we're not caught in a vicious circle. We have the power by our choice and our awareness to raise ourselves in that evolutionary spiral. Unfortunately, in some periods of history, like between the age of Aries and the Piscean age, we probably regressed there. We were probably more spiritually smart 2,000 years ago than we are today.
Right.
But those ideas, those seminal ideas, they can change and they can morph, but the true and the good ideas that motivate us as human beings can be suppressed, but they will never die because they're an intrinsic truth that we seek for in our souls.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's why I think you see all this Gnostic material and the ancient spirituality, you know, coming to the fore, not just, you know, with me, but there's many people out there, and they're saying the same thing in a, you know, a different way.
I think everyone comes here with some divine homesickness, and that's what I would label what you call you felt soul sick or whatever you called it, soul. Mm-hmm. People call soul searching, you know, whatever. And I think that we do. I think that there's something like the gyroscope that's trying to keep us always balanced and regaining our balance around, you know, just really the truth of who it is that we are and what we are, and the power that comes along with that knowledge, you know. In the last few minutes here of the show today, I would like to talk a little bit about your website and also refer people to it again. But I want to also mention this. First of all, kudos to you, because I know it's recently gone through a facelift and it's beautiful. It's quite inspiring. There's a lot of information there, a lot that people can go look and learn more about some of these concepts and these themes that you write about in your book. I'm going to play, devil's advocate here. And if someone was reading the book and they said, gee, you know, I really want to know more about this one part, this one idea he has written in the book, and see how much of it's truth and how much of the book is fiction around it, how can people guide themselves to learn more? Is there a list of suggested reading, or is it on the website, more bits and pieces of things that you talk about in the book?
One of these days, it's probably a good suggestion. I probably should develop a suggested reading list at some point. I'll really take that into consideration.
Yeah.
Right now, I would say the best thing to do is go to the website, which is popeannalisa.com. That's PopeAnnalisa. That's one word, popeannalisa.com. Mm-hmm. And it has a lot of videos that exemplify different aspects of the book and the material that's behind the book. And then it has several articles that are right there on the home page that get into an exploration of some of the things that we've talked about today, Gnosticism, the marriage of myth and science, and ancient spirituality and science, Mary Magdalene, the development of this great spiritual tradition or great spiritual secret. All those are articles that you can read about in some more depth on the site. And the site also tells, obviously, more about the book itself.
Right.
You know, and about some of the reviews and other things that the book has. It's a pretty inclusive site, and thank you for that comment about the redesign. It's worked out really well. I think it's a lot more navigable now. So.
Yeah, it's really great. But let me ask another question. The First Souls, because this is called the First Souls Trilogy.
Yeah.
The First Souls, is that completely concocted by you, or is there some, is that in reference and using a term that existed already, and there's something that talks or is written in the past about the First Souls?
Well, the answer to that is yes and no. It's partially, what like some other things in the book, I give names to archetypical ideas that are exemplified in many cultures and many writings and things like that, but maybe not in such a concentrated form or labeled as such the First Souls. So the First Souls really are a symbolic representation of you, me, and all of humanity. Mm-hmm. It's the story of our fall from spirit consciousness into the consciousness of materiality, mm-hmm. and about us working our way back up that chain now that we've sort of gotten down to this this point, let's say the farthest point of projection of consciousness. It's about us working our way back up to that unity. So it's about breakdown and then breakdown leading to wholeness.
Okay, great. Very good. Any very last couple minutes of things that you want to say here, Peter, before we have to wrap up?
Well, only that my hope for people reading the book is that they do gain a sense of hope, and they gain maybe a little bit of awareness and knowledge that will stimulate them to go on to their own personal spiritual explorations. And I think that's the great thing about this book, is that the book does not come at you like it's trying to preach a new point of view.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of stuff out there, and everybody's got their own points of view that they're sort of trying to push spiritually. And I don't really think any one point of view is usually substantially better than another. But I think the one thing about this book is it just opens up doors, and it's sort of like the analogy that I always give is, if you view your spiritual growth as a highway, and along that highway there's different way stations, or let's call them bus stops, the problem with many, not just organized religions, but even, you know, some spiritual groups is that they want you to check in at their bus stop and sort of stay there and tell you that they have all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
If you stay there, you're really limiting yourself, because remember, you're on a highway.
Right.
And the purpose on the highway is to keep on traveling up the road. It's not to stop at any one point and get stuck there. So I think Pope Annalise in the First Souls Trilogy comes at the reader from that point of view. It's a signpost along the highway, but never mistake the signpost for the destination.
Right, absolutely. Well said. And it's true, and you do a good job of just that, where you offer us, people get very excited, people get very hopeful. They're also, their curiosity increases. I think you get re-energized and stimulated, because like I said, I don't know if it was intentional or not, but I think that there's something that is so subtle within the book that it triggers and stimulates, I think, a knowing that we all have that makes us want to, you know, read the next book and,
yeah,
and keep going, which is, I think, really remarkable. But I love it. I can't thank you enough, and I'm so glad I got to have a chance to spend a second hour with you, because it's just great listening to you talk, and I'm going to be following you along, and I wish you all the luck in the future and a great success.
Well, thanks for giving me the opportunity to communicate with the listeners again. I always enjoy being on your show, and it was great. Thank you.
Very good, Peter. Thank you so much.